From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Lori Walsh. The spread of a novel coronavirus has South Dakotans washing their hands, stocking up on cleaning supplies, and eyeing their financial portfolios. Also, we have questions, because even though we've known for weeks COVID-19, that's the disease caused by the novel coronavirus, would soon impact the health of the people of our state, once schools start closing and events get canceled, we pay a little more attention to public health and our role in it. South Dakota Public Broadcasting brings you daily updates on COVID-19 on our newscasts, on In the Moment, and online. Here's an early roundup of coverage from In the Moment. Now, before the South Dakota State Department of Health had confirmed any COVID-19 cases in the state, we spoke with state epidemiologist Josh Clayton about how state government was coordinating with federal government regarding test kits, protective equipment for healthcare workers, and public education. Here's what Dr. Josh Clayton had to say about getting ready for coronavirus.
We have been preparing for quite some time now. This is not something that has really kind of come out of the blue. We have known about the novel coronavirus and its transmission within China since early January. The state is monitoring the situation. You have seen some of the reports in national news about state departments of health monitoring individuals who have returned from China, and that those individuals, starting the first part of this month, first part of February, are being monitored by public health officials to make sure that those travelers don't develop the symptoms of novel coronavirus. So we are really looking at our individuals developing fever, cough, or shortness of breath that might indicate that the novel coronavirus has spread to the lungs. And so we have been monitoring the situation, been working closely with CDC, helping keep informed our healthcare partners to make sure that they are prepared if we have an individual that needs to be evaluated, and what that means for testing and what that means for the public health follow-up, really to make sure that individuals who had been exposed to a case of this novel coronavirus are notified and allowed to self-monitor for infection. We're at a little bit of a review point in our planning. We have seen the novel coronavirus spread from China to other parts of the world, South Korea, Italy, Iran, and the Department of Health and the CDC and healthcare and other folks are now ratcheting up our planning efforts to make sure that we're able to prepare for additional introductions of novel coronavirus into the state.
On Tuesday, March 10th, Governor Kristi Noem confirmed during a press conference the state's first five positive cases for coronavirus. Those numbers continue to climb. In the Moment welcomed Sanford infectious disease specialist Dr. Wendell Hoffman for a conversation about what to do now that the virus is confirmed in the state. We spoke about South Dakota's healthcare infrastructure, the availability of those crucial test kits, and what people should do now and in the future as the new virus is set to stick around. Dr. Hoffman, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you very much. Good to be with you.
These positive cases were not unexpected. We've had at least 7 weeks to prepare since the first case was discovered in the United States. Are we ready? Have we been preparing as much as possible as we can for something like this in the state of South Dakota?
So in many ways, we have been preparing for years. I mean, all the preparation that was accomplished through the 2009-2010 pandemic H1N1 has helped us out significantly because coronavirus, in many ways, acts like influenza. Although there are some fairly distinct differences. The Ebola preparations that we underwent several years ago also has helped us enormously. So the answer to your question is, you know, I think we are well prepared, although there are going to be some challenges that we all face, because we're trying to take this very seriously, and yet we're trying to say to the public, please do not panic. This virus in the United States is going to be different than this virus anywhere else, just simply because of the amazing performance overall of our public health system, the quality of our hospital care and outpatient cares, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that infrastructure and what that looks like from a testing standpoint. How are we ready, to test people?
Well, that's a great question. So, and actually, there are many layers to that kind of obvious question. It's one that is on everybody's mind right now. So the question is, first of all, who should be tested? And the CDC is still maintaining kind of the classic definition that we've seen: fever, cough, and shortness of breath. But we know that this virus has a spectrum of presentation. So from the China outbreak, we learned that about 15% of that group, in a huge epidemiologic report, had what is called severe disease, which by definition means disease severe enough to be hospitalized. Within that is then the sort of critical group of patients who actually need intensive care unit and potential ventilatory support, because the primary issue here is a viral pneumonia, and it can easily overwhelm patients who have pre-existing conditions. So the question comes back then as far as who as we test. I think that's it's a little bit of a moving target right now. The other thing that influences that is that we know that patients with COVID-19 are presenting with the symptoms of a common cold, and the frustration for both the public and, frankly, for all of us who want to know as much as we can, is that the spectrum of illness in that mild category has yet to be completely understood. But right now, the who should be tested is going to be made rather on a case-by-case basis, and we are trying to, with the best of our ability, to determine if it's more likely than not that that patient might have COVID-19 as opposed to other viruses. Of course, when patients come in and they present to our various different acute cares, urgent cares, and hospitals, they can be tested for other viral pathogens that could help, again, more likely than not, exclude COVID as a cause of their symptoms. So in terms of who is tested, it's in flux, and we certainly want to know as much as we can, and that leads to the second aspect of your question is, are we going to have the testing capabilities necessary? And right now, we're being told that there is an active process in engaging multiple different laboratories who are developing their own tests. So we have the CDC, a sort of official test that's been distributed with these testing kits. We have, I'm not sure what the number is right now, but in the hundreds, I heard 800 or so at the South Dakota lab. But you can see that with overwhelming numbers of people who want to be tested, that potentially could be overwhelmed. So we want to use discretion and wisdom in terms of deciding who we test, because again, the majority of people are going to have mild illness, and they can stay at home, they can self quarantine, so to speak, if they're ill, because we don't want as much as feasible, we don't want patients who have any respiratory symptoms to be going out. Especially in social settings, like going to see grandma, and so forth and so on, when you even have a cold. And so that's the message. And the testing thing will, I think, sort itself out. There was a glitch with the CDC. They have owned up to it, and rather than blame people, we need to learn from this and continue to move forward getting these tests as rapidly available as possible.
For people who do have underlying health concerns, and one of their big questions is about that intensive care, you know, the capacity for that, and again, that infrastructure, what can you tell people to reassure them that if this becomes, you know, more widespread in the state, that they'll be able to get the emergency care that they need, the intensive care that they need, or is that at risk of being overwhelmed?
What I think the public needs to know is that it's not like you're going to have 100,000 cases of COVID present at one time. This is a rolling process of cases that are beginning to appear, and our healthcare systems are extraordinarily sophisticated. We have detailed triage planning for being able to handle a lot of patients if they were to present at once. But it's not like a big mass casualty where you have, you know, 100 people presenting to your ER with the same thing that demands the same approach. We will continue to see this go forward, and I think the public can be very confident that the health systems in South Dakota are very much prepared to handle the very sick and ill patients.
You mentioned this is somewhat different from the flu, and as we sort of dispel some of those myths, one of the things that people who are less worried and are not necessarily inclined to change any behavior will say, it's just like the flu. Tell us a little bit, break down how this is different from the flu. So for people who think, you know, this is sort of hysterics, why is this different? Why are we so concerned about coronavirus versus influenza?
Wonderful question. So, couple of things. How is it like the flu? Well, it's like the flu in that it can be transmitted prior to the onset of symptoms, which is what makes this so difficult to kind of get our arms around. We have people who are walking around in our communities just like they did in China. I mean, the estimate over there in that very large study that I just mentioned is that at least 1% of some 44,000 confirmed cases were asymptomatic. Now, whether it's 1% or a higher percentage, we don't know. But the point is that influenza has, we've known this about influenza, you know, seemingly, quote-unquote, forever, where the virus begins to be shed out of the nose and upper respiratory tract for at least a day or so prior to the onset of symptoms. So corona is like influenza in that regard. Now, how it is unlike influenza is that the reported mortality rate of influenza is about 0.1%. Now, the current mortality estimates vary with corona, and why is that? Because I'll use the analogy of the base of the pyramid. So if we knew what the base of the pyramid is, in other words, if we knew what the denominator is, which means the total number of people who at any one point in time are infected with the coronavirus, we would be able to then calculate the true mortality. The World Health Organization estimation of 3.4% I think is way high. The closer estimate is probably at least 2+% but more likely even, and we've heard Dr. Anthony Fauci from the NIH make this statement just recently, that the estimates are maybe it's going to be closer to maybe 1%.
Right.
But even if it's 1%, it's 10 times the mortality of seasonal influenza. And like we have been saying, a small percentage of a large number is still a large number. And so we need to take this very seriously. In particular, we need to take it seriously with our vulnerable patients, and we need to take every measure possible to prevent them from becoming infected with this. Because if you take simply the age range, and again, we rely on the Chinese data, but between ages 80 and 89, the reported mortality over there is around, you know, 15%. Between 70 and 80, the reported mortality is somewhere in the 7.5%. And between 60 and 69, strictly on an age basis, it's around 4%. Once you drop below 60, the mortality rate falls off significantly. So it is like the flu, and yet it is not like the flu. And so we we need to. And another thing I would add, and that is, I think most of us feel that coronavirus is here to stay. That this is not just going to be a one-off, so to speak. It is going to be something that will incorporate itself into the community, a collection of viruses that we deal with. For instance, when we order some sophisticated testing now on the upper nasopharyngeal tract, we currently measure four other coronaviruses, which cause the common cold. Well, this may well be number five that we begin to measure on an ongoing basis. So what does that say? It says that just like the flu, we need to make both short-term and long-term kind of preparations and be armed with the knowledge that from here on out, we need to all change our behavior, which goes to the what can I do part of this. And there are certain things that the public, that we all can do, that can actually contribute to slowing this virus down.
All right. Tell us some of those things before we let you go. What are some of those things that, because one of the things that people are trying to balance is, you know, how serious should our restrictions be right now to give people time to figure things out? But we also know that this is the long-term thing. So we are not going to make we're not going to do colleges at home learning, you know, for indefinitely. So what should we do now? And what should we do? What should we expect to do long-term?
Yes. So I think the long term, I think, actually looks quite bright because, and I'm very optimistic that we will have a vaccine, but it's going to take time. I mean, if you remember the H1N1 pandemic that we became aware of in April of 2009, and then if you remember when the vaccine for H1N1 became available, which was October 2010. There you have your 18-month time frame, and literally it takes that long to test the safety, efficacy of these kinds of vaccines, because we don't want to be developing and releasing vaccines that we have questions about or that might work. So the long term is good. We have antiviral therapies that I think are quite promising, and that even could be used now under compassionate use protocol. In the short term, however, we have to revert to simple, common, everyday things, which, by the way, we should be doing anyway. So the first thing is to understand how this virus is spread, and that it is easily spread. It appears to be the major mechanism is through large droplet nuclei, which are those secretions, small secretions that fall off when we talk or sneeze or cough, about out to 3 to 6 feet around us. And so we need to be aware of that. That's why social distancing makes a lot of sense, particularly again in our vulnerable population. So if you're if you've got children and they have a cough or a sneeze, you shouldn't be taken to grandma's house, right? And we need to maintain social distancing. And if you're not ill, even with a cold, you probably should not be going out into social settings where you could place other people at risk. So social distancing is very important. We need to understand that the virus, the second thing would be this whole aspect of environmental cleaning. Because if we use the analogy, if we use the example of the respiratory droplets going out from us and landing on external surfaces, and there is some evidence, I think, of that environmental contamination around infected peoples can be picked up on the hands of other individuals, which then are brought to the mouth and then could be acquired. And so, additionally, this virus is one of these so-called envelope viruses, which are enormously susceptible to common everyday cleaning solutions. So things like Lysol, Clorox, the regular kinds of cleaning stuff that we have in our homes should be adequate to completely clean these surfaces. And so I think reasonable environmental cleaning is I think, also something else we can do. Lastly, washing our hands is so important. As a population, we don't do this very regularly, and even when we do, we don't do it correctly. And remember, you don't need to have hand sanitizer. That washing with good old-fashioned soap and water, even regular soap that's not necessarily antibacterial, If you moisten your hands first and then you wash for at least 20 seconds, which is what the data show, and then dry your hands after, you can be reasonably assured that at that moment, at least, you're ridding your hands of potential organisms that that could be spread.
That's Sanford infectious disease specialist Dr. Wendell Hoffman. Now, one of the things that distinguishes COVID-19 from other viruses, such as influenza, is the fact that no therapeutic treatments are currently available to fight it once it takes hold. A South Dakota research company is working to change that. Eddie Sullivan is president and CEO of SAB Biotherapeutics. He joins us to explore how his organization is positioned for COVID-19 therapeutics. Eddie Sullivan, welcome back.
Hi, Lori. Thank you.
Now, you've been a frequent guest on Innovation with Kara Hetland, so many of our listeners know the cutting-edge research that's happening right here in the state. But for those who don't, give us a little overview of your lab and sort of the infrastructure you have for research and development.
Well, SAB Biotherapeutics is co-located here with Sanford Research, and for those that don't know, we have been working on a project for several years to be able to produce human antibodies in these unique animals that we have. In this case, it's cattle, where we can produce very large amounts of human antibodies, and we can target those antibodies to specific diseases. And so we have been working in infectious disease for quite a long time. And those diseases include everything from influenza to things like Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome coronavirus, which is one of our most advanced programs. In fact, that program has been through an initial phase clinical trial that was specifically for safety. And so we're using the things that we learned about that MERS coronavirus to be able to also respond to COVID-19. And so we are currently working on it. We are, you know, our network all over the country has been lit up in being able to respond to this. We're working with universities and labs all over the country, and in fact have been in contact with the CDC, FDA, NIH, and all of the organizations around the country that are responding to this. And that's because SAB has the most advanced coronavirus specific therapeutic that's in the clinic to date. Now we're creating one that's specific to COVID-19.
How different are they? How much does that matter that you are on this path already as far as how closely these are related?
Well, it's certainly given us a lot of information about how to respond specifically to this particular virus. So we don't here at SAB use any live virus, and I want our community to know that, but we use specific subunits of the virus that we can vaccinate these animals to that are non-infectious. But they create antibodies in the animals that do neutralize the virus. We can take the antibodies from these animals, purify them out. They're fully human. They have been designed to be specifically human antibodies. And then we can use that to treat people that are sick with the disease. So I want to emphasize that this is not a vaccine. This is actually, which are, you know, of course, to prevent the disease. This is actually to treat those that have been infected.
So for most people, they would think about influenza therapeutics, and they would think like I can't remember what that medicine is called, but if you went in soon enough, you would get some kind of treatment
Tamiflu.
From your doctor. Tamiflu, thank you. Am I on the right track there? Am I making the right connection, or is that off somehow?
It's very similar. The difference is drugs like Tamiflu are small molecule drugs that are called antivirals. The difference with what SAB Biotherapeutics is doing is that we're actually producing the natural proteins that our bodies use to fight disease. We call them antibodies. And in our case, we are creating the same kinds of antibodies that our bodies would naturally produce in response to this infection. And, you know, when we get sick, it's simply because our bodies are overwhelmed with that infection. And so what we're doing is we're producing these antibodies in these animals, purifying them out, and then when someone is sick with this particular virus, we would give them additional antibodies that would help them fight the disease. And these antibodies are essentially working with the patient's immune system in order to help them to recover.
That's fascinating. Tell us, you've mentioned being in contact with the CDC and NIH and the FDA, and I'm wondering about funding and if there has been any specific increase in resources on a federal level to help SAB do the work that needs to be done.
So, of course, we have been in contact now for nearly 6 weeks with not only the regulatory agencies like FDA and those that are responding to the disease like CDC, but also the funding agencies like BARDA, which is a part of HHS. We do work with the Department of Defense as well on projects. And so I think all of us know, you know, from the news last week that the president signed an appropriations for $8.3 billion to respond to COVID-19. And, of course, now these funding agencies are going through the process to provide that funding to those companies that are able to produce solutions. And so we're in almost daily contact with these agencies on being able to provide information on where we're at with the development of our response. And, you know, we started actually producing antibodies in our animals actually last week. And so we're moving forward quite quickly. And, of course, as Dr. Hoffman mentioned previous to me coming on the show here, both vaccines as well as therapeutics take time to develop, and that is going to take some time. And, of course, they are using some drugs that are already available to see if they help with this disease. But simultaneously, we're working on drugs that will be specifically targeted to the disease itself.
And this is maybe a difficult question to answer, but it's the one everybody wants to know, which is how fast is fast and how soon could some kind of therapeutic be in the hands of physicians?
Well, I will tell you that that takes an enormous effort, and SAB will have a candidate available sometime in the summer for evaluation. And then, of course, it depends on what requirements will be placed in order to be able to move this into the clinic. It will require that there are controlled clinical trials to evaluate both the safety and efficacy of any therapeutic or vaccine that is put out there. And so those controlled clinical trials will happen first before either the vaccines or the therapeutics will be made available generally. Now, the exception is something that I think has been mentioned, and that would be that in certain cases, the FDA can agree to make therapeutics available under what's called emergency use authorization. But there's very strict guidelines on being able to make that available. But certainly in cases like this, that can happen.
And then are you in control of manufacturing, presuming that you get to that point when we talk about, you know, how widespread can the or how widely can the therapeutics be distributed? That's another layer there to make things available to the most people if they do work. Is that part of what you work with, or is it by the time it gets to that point, is it beyond your scope?
No, we actually are developing the manufacturing systems to be able to manufacture the product that would be available essentially worldwide.
Yeah.
And so we're, you know, we're doing that with our processes here and are working very diligently to be able to scale up that manufacturing process.
Does that manufacturing happen in South Dakota or in other places across the country or world?
Well, certainly our animals are here in South Dakota, and so regardless of whatever purification processes happen, there will be a component of that manufacturing that happens here in South Dakota. We have some manufacturing capacity here, and we're currently working very hard to increase the scale of that manufacturing capacity here in South Dakota. But of course, we're also in discussions with others that have manufacturing capacity around the country, because it's so critical that we be able to scale this up when we have this product available for evaluation and for being able to put into patients.
Right. And if you're just tuning in, we're looking ahead here quite a bit, and we're not at that stage yet. So don't misunderstand here. My guest is Eddie Sullivan, President and CEO of South Dakota's SAB Biotherapeutics. And for people, Eddie, who are on the phone and say, do you need more cattle? This is a very special herd. Tell us a little bit about this herd of cattle at the lab.
Sure. So these animals are at one of SAB's farms here in South Dakota, and they are very special animals because, again, we have done work, very specific work, to allow these animals to produce the fully human version of these antibodies. And so they are unique from any other cattle that exist in the world, and they can produce very large amounts of human antibody. The interesting thing about this is, because these animals are born producing human antibodies, they actually recognize human antibody as being part of themselves. Wow. But the advantage is that when we put these antibodies into humans, humans recognize them as being human. And so that's what allows us to do this very, very safely, and allows these antibodies to work within the human immune system.
Well, that work is astonishingly, and what a great South Dakota science story. Anything else I should have asked you about this process? We're hoping to have you back as this research develops, so we can kind of follow it. But anything else that you wanted to say today before we let you get back to work?
Well, I appreciate certainly the comments made previously by Dr. Hoffman on all of the things all of us need to be doing and be prepared. But SAB is hard at work looking for solutions to be able to treat what can be a very serious disease.
As South Dakotans weigh decisions about public health and personal well-being, we're also considering our personal finances. Rick Kaler is a wealth advisor and financial therapist. He joins In the Moment frequently to discuss the emotions behind money and how our money scripts can impact our financial health. As investors express their concerns with the government response to coronavirus in the U.S., Kaler recommends experiencing the emotions of financial volatility in a way that doesn't damage your financial future. Rick Kaler, first of all, thank you for joining us today. And we're going to take a little bit of a different turn with our conversations today, but connect it to a lot of the other things we've been talking about, because a lot of people are sort of panicking about coronavirus or COVID-19. And we see that panic in the stock market, and people are calling their financial advisors now and saying, what do I do? So what do we do? Where do you want to begin with this? With it? First of all, you're getting calls too, aren't you? People are wondering.
So far, I've had one call from a client, but I just got off the phone with a national organization of financial planning practitioners asking me to speak to them next week, because if you've been an advisor, financial planner for 10 years, mm-hmm. you've never been through a downturn. You've never been through a panic. And even the advisors are starting to have some difficult emotions.
All right. You've been through panic before.
I have been.
Tell me about just a few of the panics that you've that you've seen in your career as a financial advisor. Certainly 2008.
Yeah. 1987 sticks in my mind, because that was the week that I think in one day the market was down 25%. So to put that into context, that would be pretty close to a 9,000 7,000 point drop in one day.
Okay.
Of the Dow.
Wow.
I remember that very poignantly. And so there's been the dot-com crash of 2000. And then, you know, I think 2008, especially September to February of 2009, was a pretty memorable time. Mm-hmm. And actually, the week that we just went through was the largest one-week drop since 2008.
Really?
And it comes... Right. It wasn't, it was just 7 days before that the market had hit all-time highs.
Sure.
So it's causing a lot of people to be pretty scared.
Some of the things that trigger that quick evidence of fear and panic is it just worries about what's going to happen if people have to socially isolate or are quarantined, or is it actual, you know, what we're seeing happening with Apple or other companies are having immediate true impacts?
Well, in typical Lori fashion, you have zeroed in on what is going to make this one a little bit different. Mm-hmm. Because it's not, I want to say it's not a, quote, normal recession or a normal pullback, in that there is another emotional component going on, which you articulated, which is the fear of the virus, the fear of being quarantined, the fear of death and the high fatality percentage of this particular virus. So I think the emotional component of this is even more important than normal panics, if you can call it normal, because our brains aren't usually functioning really well as investors when things look really bleak. But in this case, you've got the your personal safety concerns along with it.
Hmm. So I want to talk about some of the specific things that people should be thinking about doing. But before I give everybody what they want with those questions, I'm just going to guess, Rick, that so much of that panic and that emotional response really ties into some of our money beliefs, doesn't it?
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
When you look at it logically, and I do not mean to minimize the
right.
deaths that have happened. But globally, we have about 2,900 deaths. We have 85,000 people that have been sick. So when you look at that and compare it with other issues, you're going, is this really a logical response? And no panic is, especially when you're talking about the stock market, is ever logical. 2008 wasn't logical. So the stock market is illogically driven because it's behaviorally driven.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something to keep in mind, but it doesn't mean that it's not happening. It is
right.
happening. People are illogical, and this response is as such. Nevertheless, there is a real reason to be concerned economically, because our economy is supported by consumer spending.
Yeah.
I've often laughed that people like me preach paying off your debt, living on what you make, or hopefully living on less than what you make. Well, if everybody in the country did that, we would have a recession because consumer spending would contract.
Right.
So we have a situation where the manufacturing sector was already in a recession because of the China trade wars. And so it was the retail sector that was kind of keeping things going. Well, now retail's being hit. People are going to stay away from entertainment and spending money, especially the travel sector is going to be hit hard. And we're going to have that contraction. So you can easily see how this could start a recession.
This reminds me of, and I've talked about this on this program before, because it's just one of those moments that I'll never forget, which was after September 11th, 2001, and President George Bush coming on television and saying, don't let them win, keep the economy going, go enjoy yourself, fly to Disney World. And I think that was the first time that I ever had a realization that what could happen if everybody just got frightened and decided to stay home. It was an eye-opener for me. This is different because at that time, you know, there, although, you know, back then we were still trying to figure out what the threat really was, but this is different because it's a virus and, you know, it may come to a city near you at some point. But there's a leadership aspect to this where people are saying, hey, keep going, because the results could be kind of terrifying. Keep calm, but take action.
Yes. So it does call on all of us to rethink our own personal hygiene. And, you know, I've been more aware of touching my face. And I just got back from London. Mm-hmm. And I was anxious about traveling and being in planes. And so it is a good time to be really aware of our hygiene. It's nevertheless, we are dealing with something where you can be contagious and be asymptomatic. That's kind of something new. So there's certainly cause of concern, and I think it's kind of a foregone conclusion. There's going to be short-term disruptions, potentially supply issues and things of that sort. I don't think it's going to be a major long-term concern to anybody's investment portfolio.
Let's talk about the impact. What are there ways to sort of, you know, predict or anticipate, estimate what the impact will be? Looking at other things like this, other outbreaks, other panics.
Yeah, I think so. I think if we had to guess how far down the stock market might go, I'd say, well, try 36%. No, I don't have a crystal ball. Right. That is simply the average fall in a normal bear market. And when you think about it, we're 12 years into this bull market. It's unprecedented, the run that we've had. So people like myself have been saying for a long time, we're going to see a bear market, which is a fall of 20% or more. In the U.S. stock market, we're going to see a recession. You do not have to be a rocket scientist to come out with those prognostications.
Okay.
What you do have to be is a soothsayer to say when. So we know that this, something like this, and I don't even know this is this yet.
Right.
But because we're only down 13% right now, but we know this is coming. So, you know, it quite frankly is no different from any other panic when it looks so bleak at the bottom. Now, are we at a bottom? Well, it wouldn't be a bear market if we are. It'd be a correction. So, you know, again, nobody knows. But the really important thing, and we've talked about this before, is to separate my emotional responses from my actions.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where emotional intelligence comes in, and it is so important that I'm looking at the stock market falling, I'm hearing all the warnings about the coronavirus, and fear is just rising in me, and I have anxiety, and I have a couple of decisions. One is to acknowledge that fear and that anxiety, go, oh, wow, I am just scared to death. The other one is to resist that, saying, how can I get immediate relief from this?
Huh.
And that is pick up the phone, call my advisor, and tell him to sell. And that can help eliminate immediate anxiety. Like, oh, whew, good. At least I got out. But the rebound of that is going to create even more anxiety, knowing when to get back in. Or if when you sell out, the market starts running up, it just sets a person up for even worse anxiety and can do financial damage to a person.
And I want to tie this back to this idea of, you know, even if you, I think there are a lot of people who don't necessarily have, they have not built wealth, they don't invest, in a lot of things, and this impacts them, you know, less than it maybe impacts somebody who considers themselves a savvy and wise investor, although many of us have money in pension funds and 401ks and retirement plans. But even for the people who really feel like they're playing this game well and have made good decisions, that panic can take over pretty much anybody. And that gets back to this idea of doing the emotional work around your money and your finances and your wealth before there's a panic, before there's a downturn.
Yes, hopefully they've been listening to your show for a while.
I think so. I've been reading your books and doing financial therapy along with their investments. It's not just for people who are in debt and trying to get out. It's for all of us, yeah.
And you're exactly right, because am I feeling anxiety? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I'm feeling anxiety, especially with my international travel schedule. Mm-hmm. Anybody can, with what's going on here, it's like I said, it has this double component of both the markets reacting and a very real physical threat.
Right.
So separating and being able to recognize I'm scared, I am frightened, and being able to acknowledge that just to yourself can completely change your behavior or your actions, and being able to separate the difficult emotion from, so does this require any action? And usually the only action that's really required is acknowledging it and feeling it.
Hmm. How long before, you know, things turn around again? If you do nothing, if we watch the chart go down, and we turn on the news and see how much the Dow has dropped today, how long before it rebounds after something like this? Usually, historically,
yeah. Well, I think historically bear markets run about 9 months, if I'm right. Mm-hmm. They're much shorter than bull markets, okay? But they tend to be steeper and quicker. And so the chances are that this is going to last for a few months. The chances are it could be very scary. And the chances are when the things look the worst, that's about the time the market would start going up. And people are going, why is the market going up? The world's ending.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of a typical pattern. I sat beside, ironically, a virus flu researcher that works on the vaccine coming back from London.
Yeah.
And he had said, well, you, first of all, this is a pandemic, even though the WHO's saying it isn't yet. He said, second, it's going to be with us a year or two. Mm-hmm. And what we hope is that it moves slowly so it doesn't overwhelm our capacity to take care of people and to deal with it. So I think, again, nobody knows, but I think we need to be prepared that the virus part's going to be with us for a while. The markets are going to do what they do, and the chances are it'll be steep, ugly, and short. I mean,
yeah.
If you think about 2008, the worst time was between September and of 2008 and February 2009.
Yeah.
It felt like a lifetime.
Yeah.
But it was 6 months.
What are some of the money beliefs you should check for at this point when you feel that that panic, those emotions?
Yeah. I think the first thing to check for is the feeling. Am I feeling fear, anxiety? You know, what's going on? The money belief is behind that. So if I can find the feeling and then go, okay, what's the belief? What is true for me? And it could be an unlimited number of beliefs, whether it's with sicknesses in general, or fears that I'm going that I'm going to be lose everything and be a bag lady, or
never be able to retire. I've messed this up. I can't. I shouldn't have done it. I shouldn't have listened to that person. I can't be trusted, you know, with my money. Investing isn't safe. There's all kinds of things. Yeah,
and especially if you've just recently gotten into the market,
right?
Like last week or 2 weeks ago. See, I knew the stock market's gambling, and I might. Well, we can go on a lot of different routes, but one thing important in a person that has listened to us much will know the importance of diversifying. Mm-hmm. And if a person has a diversified portfolio, even though the stock markets are down 10%, your portfolio is probably only down 3 or 4%. So we have so much focus on the U.S. stock market. But if you're diversified, that may only make up 15 or 20% of your entire portfolio. And I can't tell you how often people will get into their portfolio and they'll go, oh, I thought it was going to be much worse than that, because all we hear is the S&P 500 or the Dow.
Right.
So one thing might be check your portfolio, and that may help anxiety, just to find out what is real.
Throughout the week, President Donald Trump and administration officials discussed potential payroll tax breaks and modifications to insurance policy. What can the federal government do during an economic crisis? What's in the toolbox for fiscal and monetary policy? South Dakota State University economics professor Joe Santos joined us for insight. Welcome back, Joe.
Thank you, Lori.
All right. It feels like we're standing in unknown territory in a lot of ways. So tell me a little bit about how we begin thinking about macroeconomic policies being suited to this particular crisis.
Yeah, that's a big question, but one I thought we better address, right?
Yeah. Right.
Let's say it is a global pandemic. There is really nothing in the macroeconomic policy tool shed, if you will, that specifically addresses the immediate consequences of this sort of crisis. Monetary policy can't create a vaccine. But as you mentioned in your intro, the consequences of this sort of global slowdown, if that in fact is what the crisis unleashes, are the sorts of things driven by expectations on the parts of households, concerns, uncertainties on the parts of business, and so forth. Those are the sorts of things that policies might be able to address. But again, the immediate effect, unfortunately, there is a feeling of macroeconomic hopelessness or helplessness. The Federal Reserve, in concert with other central banks, now are discussing, as we speak, the possibility of lowering interest rates somewhat substantially, at least relative to what the plan was even 3 weeks ago, which was essentially to probably do nothing. Mm-hmm. So there are discussions of immediate policy. And in fact, if anyone's watching the markets right now, which is kind of hard not to do, you'll notice things are very green as opposed to red this morning, because the anticipation is that the Fed may in fact react. And some of that is arithmetic. If interest rates go down, then the current valuation of a firm that is presumably going to generate profits far off into the future goes up. So all else equal, lower interest rates mean higher stock prices. But again, whether or not lower interest rates really can do anything immediately is a very open question.
So how do we start visiting this macroeconomic tool shed to take a look inside and sort of see what we can see?
Yeah. So, you know, if the crisis is going to do anything, and I suspect it will, it's not going to be the end of days, but it will have macroeconomic consequences. It's already having those consequences, say, in China. And China is a very large part of the global economy now. So those consequences are going to ripple through the world economy. There's no doubt about any of that. The question is really just scale. The uniqueness of this, economically speaking, pandemically speaking, it's got its own uniqueness. But economically speaking, is that it drives both demand and supply, right? So I'll leave it to an economist to bring up supply and demand within the first 4 minutes of a conversation. But, on the demand side, you can imagine individuals who are perhaps temporarily unemployed, separated from the labor force, or perhaps just not inclined to go to the marketplace, literally wanting to stay somewhat isolated, not being sure of what the future holds for their household income. And so those are sort of demand features that can slow demand, slow spending. And that's actually something that macroeconomic policy generally could address. Unfortunately, the supply chain consequences of this crisis, literally not being able to get the goods to where you need them and so forth, and more importantly, to produce the goods that you need to produce, because again, those goods require a combination of machinery and labor, and labor contracts viruses. So you end up with this gumming of the production works that also has supply consequences. So it really is two forces acting against the macroeconomy, both obviously in the wrong direction. The second of which, there aren't a lot of policy prescriptions in general, even if this were not a virus-induced supply shock. Supply shocks are an order of magnitude more difficult to address with policy. But anyway, getting back to your question, though, what is in the tool shed? Well, we've already discussed monetary policy. So that would be essentially moving interest rates. And in this case, it would mean lowering interest rates to try to stimulate demand. Again, there's that focus on demand. It's about all you can do with monetary policy is stimulate demand. You also, though, have fiscal policy, which listeners will be forgiven for forgetting about because we never talk about. But fiscal policy is, of course, changing tax rates and changing spending, presumably temporarily, in response to some sort of macroeconomic crisis. So this is stabilization policy. It's not to be used all the time. But when it is used temporarily in these very specific ways, that too can be a way to deal with an economic slowdown. So you can lower interest rates on the monetary policy side of the ledger, if you will. But you can also lower taxes. You can increase government spending. Again, not to put too fine a point on this or be too grim, but none of this, of course, is in any way a vaccine. But right. These are ways of dealing with the aftermath.
So one of the things before we kind of get into breaking down like allocation policy and stabilization policy, mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you is the importance, because we've talked about before, of certainty when we're talking about international trade and trade deals, the certainty mm-hmm. People want to feel like, you know, you mentioned today the markets are, you know, recovering a little bit in the anticipation that some action is going to be taken. And I'm wondering about some of these companies who are taking action. Amazon comes to mind. Early, you know, restricting travel and making, you know, new hires or, you know, video conference only. They're already taking some sort of restricting of movement action. Is that just protecting their business or does that have an impact on their stocks that they're demonstrating to, you know, to the public that we know what we're doing. We've got a plan sure. and we're taking action already.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think there definitely is a conventional wisdom, and conventional wisdom isn't always correct, of course, but a conventional wisdom out there that doing something is better than doing nothing. And so perhaps there can be a sort of second order objective. I wouldn't say it's a first order, but a second order objective to try to appear to be doing something that's effective and sensible in a way that can prop up the valuation of the firm. But I do think the first order objective is to try to do business, if you will, through the crisis. And that will, you know, necessarily mean reorganizing production processes, if not manufacturing supply chains. There's not a lot you can do there in the short run. But certainly the way you organize individuals, the way they meet, and you mentioned things like, you know, using technology to meet and so forth. I think that's probably a first order goal there, is to try to keep business running. You mentioned certainty and its other side, uncertainty. And that's really, I think, what is gripping not just financial markets, which are in some respects, larger respects, I think that most will admit, a reflection of economic activity more generally. These are these markets are dealing with uncertainty, and uncertainty is different than risk. This is a little in the weeds, but economists don't use the terms interchangeably. When you're referring to risk, you're referring to really understanding what we call the probability distribution. I could tell you there's a 20% chance something's going to happen. There's a risk it could happen. I'm using the word risk because I have a sense of how the probabilities lay out. Uncertainty is terrifying for commerce because that's where, again, very, very, you know, technically speaking, you don't know what the distribution looks like. You have no idea what the curve looks like, the bell curve or whatever. You can't identify it. So you don't have any sense of how bad bad is. You don't know where the bottom is. And I think that's right now what we're seeing is firms are dealing really with uncertainty as opposed to risk. And that more than anything will drive market valuations down. And so as a practical matter, stock prices down. Again, there's always a bit of overreaction in a world of quarterly capitalism, as we call it, where these firms have to demonstrate their worth, you know, every 3 months. And so they focus on the short term and traders focus on the short term, perhaps more than they should. But there is a good reason for the downward pressure in the value of these firms.
All right, let's talk about allocation policy, redistribution policy, and stabilization policy.
Okay, so yeah, those are the three bits to essentially fiscal policy, though macroeconomists would really just think of stabilization policy as fiscal policy. So again, fiscal policy is using taxes and spending. But if you're using taxes and spending to try to change the existing wedges of the pie, that's redistribution. So that's not about producing more stuff. Allocation policy is trying to use tax policy in a way to really increase the efficiency of the economy. So there's nothing particularly wrong with the economy when you're implementing allocation policy. You just think that perhaps government could adjust its position in the economy in such a way that goods are allocated more efficiently. And then there's stabilization.
Give me an example of that.
Yeah. Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Lower taxes, marginal income tax rates on labor,
okay.
Or
right.
Lower taxes on in certain types of investment spending. So if you think that a particular use of labor or a particular use of machinery and equipment or an innovation of that sort of machine and equipment would motivate more economic output than we have now, you think you can do this by tweaking tax rates, that would be allocative.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So stabilization is the one we think of when we're talking about a recession. So strictly speaking, if the government were to talk about lowering taxes right now or increasing government spending in order to deal with an economy that's underwhelming because it's producing less than we reason it could at its potential. There's that gap there, and you're trying to close that gap. That's when we really think of fiscal policy as a stabilization policy. And so, as I sort of joke in the blog, it's right now we often think of it as the dullest tool in the shed. I'm not necessarily advocating that we go out and use it, but it is another policy tool. And historically, for the last several decades, with the exception of the financial crisis in 2008, we have not thought of fiscal policy as a go-to policy. It has been monetary policy that has played that role. And again, I think you're seeing this in very real time this morning. White House, spoke open letter form to the Fed saying you need to get in there and make things right or fix things or at least ameliorate the damage that this is causing. That's not just this administration. That's been the sort of go-to mentality for several decades. And so fiscal policy, taxing and spending to stabilize the economy has not been the first thing we reach for on the, you know, the policy shelf, if you will, for several decades. The heyday of fiscal policy was probably in the late 60s, early 70s. And since then, it's been sort of taken a back seat to monetary policy as our go-to.
Is that because of whose responsibility it is?
Well, this is where our friends in political science, I think, have
yes.
A lot more to contribute here than than my friends in economics.
Yeah.
Because the political scientists have long taken this view that and other fields, sociologists have played an important role in all this as well, is that basically it's a blame game. And the Fed, because of its perceived autonomy. It's, you know, independent, we like to say, whether or not that's accurate. There's a great book called The Myth of Independence. You can imagine where that one's going. Yeah. But it, you know, this independence affords not just the administration, but also the legislature, the opportunity to essentially assign blame to the Fed when things are not going well. So when they are going well, things are just going well. So you can just benefit from the sort of afterglow of that. But also you can say, well, it's going well because the legislature essentially identified this central bank and positioned it in an independent way so it could do all the right things. So ultimately, it comes back to its creator, the Congress, for taking credit. And when it doesn't do well, well, then you could very easily point the finger at the central bank and say, well, this is your domain. Macroeconomics is monetary policy. They're one and the same. There's nothing we could do. In fact, the statement from the administration this morning, and this is, again, not specific to this administration. You can find other statements like this in other days, was the Fed needs to do something. I don't think the Congress could act with tax cuts anytime soon. You know, that was, I'm paraphrasing. But that's textbook. That's what we've seen for several decades. And so there are folks out there right now who are advocating for a more active role for fiscal policy. I'm not necessarily doing so here, but I'm just saying that's a growing force in macroeconomics right now, sort of arguing that perhaps fiscal policy should be allowed to come back into the policy space in ways that it hasn't been for decades.
What do we know as we look at school.blog.com? How did you sort of work some numbers up to show us the impact of this kind of policy in the past? Let's go look at a little history.
Sure. So I took some great work by Christina and David Romer, who's a macroeconomics dynamic duo at UC Berkeley, who've done a lot of work, not just on the effects of fiscal policy, but in the process of trying to identify what they determine are actually quite significant effects of changes in taxes. So stabilization policy through tax changes could work is sort of the punchline of their work. But in the process of doing that work, they had to go back and look at the narrative record for evidence that the Congress and the administration even intended, right, to implement fiscal policy. You have to find that shock in order to test if it had any effect on the economy. So there's this really interesting byproduct of their work where they go back into the all sorts of congressional records and economic reports of the president and some, I'm guessing, poor RAs who spent sleepless nights going deep into this narrative record and saying, okay, this one is stabilization policy. Put this in that pile. That one, you know, that piece of legislation is allocation policy, to use the term you used earlier. Put it in that pile. And so you end up with these piles that you could take a look at. And so this is what I put up on school, are these charts where they're just spikes and they're events, they're stabilization events driven by fiscal policy. And what you notice is there are a bunch of spikes until about the 80s, and then the spikes mostly disappear. It's a pretty interesting image. There's a lot of fiscal policy before about the 80s and essentially no evidence of it from their work after. And in fact, their term is, you know, the heyday term I used earlier was their term describing roughly the 60s to the 70s. So it wasn't necessarily the objective of their work, but in doing their work, they you know, went through the congressional record and determined that fiscal policy, particularly through tax cuts or increases, if you're trying to slow an economy down, have become quite rare in the last several years.
And again, is there an indication that that is a political winds sort of transformation, or were there reasons to look back from a macroeconomic standpoint and say it wasn't working, or there were consequences that were not, you know, that made it less effective, or is it just politically divisive? What do we have an indication thereof? Yeah.
I that's a good question. I think part of it probably had to do with economic crises in the 70s that were attended by inflation, which is sort of the purview of the Fed. So that's sort of put the focus on the Fed. And then you had a kind of a new norm in American culture that was, you know, smaller government perhaps could be better and so on. And, you know, a Reagan revolution and so on in the 80s and early 90s that sort of continued with the first Bush administration. And so, yeah, I think there was the sort of intellectual norm that said, look, fiscal policy really isn't the solution. And I cite Robert Lucas in his 2003 presidential address where he said in a mostly nonpartisan way that, you know, our emphasis on the business cycle is sort of needs to diminish because that problem's been solved. You know, well, ironies aside, 5 years later, there's a financial crisis. But nevertheless, that was the thinking. And I think some of it, to your point, was driven by politics and a concern for the financial consequences. The debt is quite large now. Mm-hmm. The deficit is quite large, both as a share of GDP. And so I think some folks are just looking at that and thinking, look, there's really no ammunition here. We can't move. We don't have the policy space on the fiscal side.
Interestingly, though, a move would not have to be permanent. A move, you know, when we look at what the Fed does, we're constantly watching them to see what the next move will be. If you lowered taxes at a particular time, with the idea that you would raise them again when things had stabilized, you know, who wants to be the person to raise the taxes after you?
This is such a good point, and that's the other side argues. Look, there are deficits, there are debts, but you don't. Part of that is because the fiscal policy has actually been pro-cyclical. We've cut taxes during expansions, let's say. Yeah. If we were more disciplined about this and reserve stabilization policy only for stabilization and not to sort of goose the economy, which, again, is across party lines, then to your point, it wouldn't have to be this case where you lower taxes and then it becomes persistent and you never raise them again. There could be a new intellectual norm, a sort of macroeconomic culture where we all understand, as you said, that just like the Fed lowers rates and then raises them, you could lower taxes during a crisis and then you could restore tax policy to what it was before the crisis, and in doing so, restore the fiscal position of the government. So it needn't have this long-term effect on the budgetary position of the United States Treasury in the way that it often does, precisely because, as you said, every step in the process involves discretion, and nobody wants to be the one that turns the dial back up on the tax rate.
So can it be automated in some ways that there is a sense of we all understand what the parameters are and we are at least encouraged, we being, you know, Congress, encouraged to act accordingly once those markers show up? Can it, you know, can you take the human politics out of it at all?
You can try. That's very popular on monetary policy side. It's not as popular on fiscal, but the theory applies here as well. That is, if you had a rule, you'd have a commitment mechanism. And I would add a second order effect, which is you and I may not fret to the extent that we fret and act preemptively when we see the economy slowing if we understand that there is a response that's going to be imposed by a rule, right? We can, as you said, sort of adopt the rule in our everyday life, recognizing that there will be some sort of automatic stabilizer beyond the sorts of automatic stabilizers that exist now. And from that, we may be able to restore our own confidence. So there's a lot of theory behind why something like that would work. But of course, fiscal policy necessarily involves congressional appropriations in some form and, you know, tax policy and so forth. And that is inherently political, as, you know, perhaps it should be. But nevertheless, we haven't managed to depoliticize it, relatively speaking, to the extent that we have monetary policy. And so it's very difficult to establish that sort of commitment. But there are folks who are actively working in this field arguing that what you just suggested, a sort of policy rule implemented for fiscal policy, might be what we need. And the rule would also indicate that rates would have to go up, you know, when certain indicators suggested that they should go up. And so you'd have to do that in both directions. And so back to your earlier point, perhaps fiscal policy wouldn't mean raiding the Treasury, you know, every time you lower taxes and then fail to raise them again.
South Dakota Public Broadcasting offers daily updates regarding the statewide response to COVID-19. Find all our coverage online at sdpb.org/COVID. Tune in to In the Moment Live on SDPB Radio at 11 a.m. Central, 10 Mountain. In the Moment podcasts are produced by Josh Heyer. For Josh and Steve Zwemke and Chris Loffrey, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.